There's something to offend just about everyone in Robert Wright's new book, The Evolution of God. The book recounts in harrowing detail how the early Israelites invoked Yahweh to wreak vengeance on the Babylonians who'd conquered them. And Wright's no kinder to Christianity. His Jesus is not the prophet of peace and love, but an apocalyptic preacher obsessed with the approaching end times. Despite all this religious mayhem, Wright also thinks there's an underlying moral order, and he believes that humanity is marching, however wobbly, toward moral truth. So how can we come to grips with our ancestors' ideas about God? Wright told Steve Paulson that we need to understand the rough-and-tumble politics of the ancient Middle East.
At its birth, monotheism was fundamentally about retribution. Israel was a small nation in a bad neighborhood that had gotten kicked around, and this culminated in the exile, which was humiliating, and it dispossessed the Israelites. The temple was destroyed. It's not crazy to compare the mindset of the Israelites at this point to the mindset of the Palestinians, who feel humiliated and dispossessed. In the book, I argue that this kind of mindset brings out the belligerence in a religion. And I think it did at the birth of monotheism.
So you're drawing a link then between the political survival of a people or the political power of a people and the God they believed in. They somehow became one and the same.
Well, there was always in ancient times a close association of politics and gods. I mean, the victor of a war was always the nation whose god beat the other god. But what I think happened, the specific political dynamic that I think monotheism reflected at its birth, was Israel's desire and maybe plan to punish other nations by A, denying the very existence of their gods, and B, envisioning a day when their God Yahweh would make this point by actually subjugating the nations. This is very clear in 2nd Isaiah. It's not talked about much.
So Yahweh becomes a tool for Israelite kings to consolidate political power?
In the run-up to monotheism, I think you see that, especially with King Josiah, who I talk about at length in the book. You know, I think Israel was polytheistic for a lot longer than some people think it was. A lot of things factored into its movement toward monotheism, and one of them was, yes, a king who wanted to eliminate domestic political rivals, and those political rivals would have claimed access to various gods other than Yahweh. And so King Josiah wanted to eliminate them, and he killed some of them, but he also made it illegal to worship their gods. So I think that gets you up to monotheism. On the brink of monotheism, I think the exile pushes you over, and at that point you have a very kind of belligerent, I would say exclusive kind of monotheism, whose very point is to exclude other nations from this kind of privileged circle of God's most favored people. However, I do think after the exile, monotheism evolves into something much more laudable and inclusive. Now Israel, the exiles are returned to Jerusalem. Israel is now in a secure neighborhood because it's part of the Persian Empire, and so are its neighbors. And you see a much sunnier side of God coming out. You see expressions of tolerance and compassion even toward nations that previously were reviled in pre-exilic scriptures. And what that shows is that I think monotheism itself is not intrinsically good or bad. It depends on the circumstances in which it finds itself.
And then for today's religious believer who reads the Bible, I mean, this gets pretty confusing because we go back to some of these early books in the Old Testament, and that is a vengeful God, a God who says at times you need to wipe out people with different religious beliefs, and then other times there are very different pictures of God within the same sacred text. It's kind of confusing, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, the contrasts are extreme. I mean, at one point in the Hebrew Bible, God is saying, I want you to annihilate nearby peoples who worship the wrong gods, and you know, lest there be any misunderstanding of what he has in mind, he says, do not leave anything alive that breathes. Not livestock, nothing. Women, children, everything goes. And then in other times, you have the Israelites not only tolerating a neighbor who worships another god, but in a sense, using that other god to validate their desire for tolerance. So they'll say to the Ammonites. You know, look, you've got your God, Chemosh. He gave you your land. We've got our God, Yahweh. He gave us our land. Can't we just get along? So there's this kind of vacillation in the Bible. There's this kind of vacillation in the Quran. I think in both cases, it's basically a question of whether people think they can gain through peaceful interaction with other people or not. And I think that's the challenge in the modern world.
Well, let's skip ahead to the next great monotheistic religion. Why did Christianity take root?
First of all, I think that the doctrines we associate with Christianity probably took root a little later than a lot of people think. I think there's reason to doubt that Jesus actually is the source of a lot of the stuff we consider most laudable in Christianity, universal trans-ethnic, transnational love, for example. I think that is a product of people like the Apostle Paul, who after the crucifixion carried the Jesus movement into the Roman Empire. And I think Paul wanted to build a network of churches. I think he was a true believer, but I also think that he went about this in a very pragmatic, business-like way. And I think in many ways, the church served as a networking service. And that was part of its appeal, certainly to elites, to like merchants. The network of Christian churches made it easier for them to travel from city to city in the Roman Empire and do business. The Roman Empire was, in a way, waiting for a church to dominate it. You know, I think beyond a certain point, when Christianity reached critical mass, then the dominance of the Roman Empire almost became inevitable.
So you're saying that later Christians, the Apostle Paul, among others, really institutionalized Christianity. But what about the historical Jesus? What do we know about him?
You know, it's popular in deciding which things that are attributed to Jesus were really said by Jesus. It's popular to say he said the good stuff and not the less good stuff. I think it's the opposite, pretty much.
He is usually seen as the great prophet of peace and love.
Yeah. But the fact is, like the Sermon on the Mount, which is a beautiful thing, does not appear in the first gospel that was written, Mark. And these views are not attributed to Jesus in the letters of Paul, which are the earliest post-crucifixion documents we have. You see Paul develop a doctrine of love and universal love, and you see that its practical value is to keep the church together, but he's not by and large attributing this stuff to Jesus. So too with love your enemies. Paul says something like love your enemies. He doesn't say Jesus said it. It's only in later gospels that this kind of stuff gets attributed to Jesus. And, you know, I should say this will seem dispiriting to some people to think that maybe Jesus wasn't the great guy we thought he was. To me, it is actually more inspiring to think that the doctrines of transnational, transethnic love were actually very likely products of a multinational kind of imperial platform. And the reason I find that inspiring is because one thing that does seem to have been in the cards in human history is that social organization grows, and it grows beyond ethnic bounds, and it comes to encompass diverse ethnicities and nations and so on. And if it is natural under those circumstances to develop doctrines that bring us closer to moral truth, like universal love, that to me is encouraging. And I think you see it in all three religions.
So if Jesus was not the figure of peace and love that he is generally thought to be, what kind of person was he?
I think he was your typical Jewish apocalyptic preacher. He was preaching that the kingdom of God was about to come. He didn't mean in heaven. He meant, you know, God's going to come down and straighten things out on this earth for good. You know, thy kingdom come in the Lord's Prayer means the kingdom comes down here. He wasn't talking about going up to heaven, I think.
But isn't the revolutionary aspect of Jesus' teachings that he made no distinctions among classes, social classes, that, I mean, essentially the poor were just as worthy as the rich, and wasn't that a sort of a radical idea for his time?
I think it's certainly quite plausible that his message was pitched toward the dispossessed. I think that part is true, but I don't think it extended beyond ethnic bounds. And I also don't think it was that original. I mean, in the Hebrew Bible, you see a number of prophets who are crying out for justice on behalf of the poor. So that wasn't a new thing that somebody would have a constituency that includes the dispossessed. I'm glad it was good. I'm sure he was in many ways a laudable person. I think more good things have been attributed to him than really bear weight.
I want to step back for a moment and talk about your overall approach to explaining the history of religion. You have obviously written a secular history. I sort of read this as a work of sociology, and you were looking at the way religion is used by various political movements and groups to gain and consolidate power. But you're pretty much ignoring the power of personal spiritual experience, what some people would call revelation. And I guess I'm wondering if you can really explain religion without acknowledging the importance of actual religious experience.
I, first of all, do think religious experience has played an important part in religion. I guess that's not that controversial a claim when you think about it. I think the Apostle Paul felt genuinely inspired. I myself have had profound experiences that maybe could be characterized as religious. Well, I certainly had some when I was young and was a believing Christian, but even since then, I mean, I did it like a one-week silent meditation retreat and had very profound experiences.
Can you tell me about that? What kinds of profound experiences did you have?
Well, first of all, as the week wore on, my consciousness, the kind of walls between me and the rest of, and other people and the rest of reality broke down a little, became much less negatively judgmental about things. You know, I remember at one point looking at a weed and thinking, I can't believe I've been killing weeds because, you know, they're as pretty as anything else. I mean, who put this label on weeds, you know? And that's just kind of a metaphor for what was changing in my consciousness. And it was completely profound by the end of the week. Now, of course, you know, a week later, I was a jerk again. It kind of wore off. But it was profound. And it was a movement toward, I think, moral truth. The truth is, you are not special. I am not special. You're not special. That, in a way, is the key adaptation that religions have to make in the modern world, is to increasingly make people better at appreciating the perspective of people in circumstances very different from their own and acknowledging the moral value of those people. And that is a movement toward moral truth. And it's an interesting thing to me that the system seems to be set up in such a way that as technology expands the realm of social organization, its ongoing coherence and integrity depends on moral progress in this sense. That's a fascinating feature of the world we live in.
Robert Wright talked with Steve Paulson. His book is called The Evolution of God.